So my plan was to sort of continue where Kevin left off in his talk. So he started saying some things about the holomorphic twist of 3D n equals 2, which is kind of fundamental to many of the applications we're seeing. Both this week and next week, and I hope we'll be able to make some of those connections clearer. And I also, I guess, before going into any details, I wanted to just revisit the question of why we care and what we're actually trying to do. Also, maybe reviewing and re-emphasizing some of the things that Kevin mentioned. And so he had a picture that looked sort of like this. There. In physics, we often have quantum systems that look completely different, but whose correlation functions are exactly the same, and there's an isomorphism on local operators and boundary conditions and extended operators and so on. And these funny isomorphisms go under the names of dualities. They may not just involve field theories, but string theories or M theories, theory. Lots of often and not just duality, but analities or many, many different ways to look at the same system. That I should say, very, very few of these have any sort of proof, even at a physics level. There are pieces of evidence and computations that one does, and self-consistency that holds the whole network of analogies together, and one proceeds from there. I believe Kevin maybe called them mysterious dualities, and many of them are. And then there's a translation. What has happened over the last few decades is a translation of both sides to mathematics. That takes place in many different settings, sometimes in an analytic world, sometimes in an algebraic or representation theoretic world. And then the physics duality becomes some sort of conjecture. That then mathematicians work on very hard using very different methods. And part of the thing that many of us are trying to do, and that this conference is morally based around, is trying to sort of factor this picture through an intermediate stage that is a purely mathematical description of the physics in some analytic or algebraic or DG setting, such that the duality makes sense, at least can be stated mathematically in terms of field theories. And then lots of various objects, numbers, categories, vector spaces, etc., can be calculated directly from the mathematical definition of the field theories. The reason we have some hope of finding some intermediate object. So we want going to factor through a mathematical fields theory, string theory, etc. The reason we have any hope for doing that, aside from just finding a general mathematical definition of quantum field theories, is that the quantities that are often of interest, and most interesting to like algebra and representation theory, or invariants of n manifolds, one doesn't need the full-on physical theory to define them. A so-called BPS sector of the theory, or better said, some sort of cohomology of the physical theory is enough. And then one can hope for a smaller, just like a description of that smaller sort of cohomology or something very close to it, some chain level thing. That is still like very close to the cohomology and doesn't involve the full complicated nature of the physical theory, and that might exist. This motivation sort of goes from field theory to interesting mathematics. And there's motivation going the other way as well. Once we have at least one mathematical definition of some BPS sector of a physical theory, we can, in principle, start computing and defining all the objects there. We sometimes find from mathematical consistency that there are physical properties that we might have missed originally in the system. How certain symmetries fit together, what the right language is for even talking about part of the physics. So that's less part of this conference, but an equally important part of this interaction. There are lots of applications of, in particular, twists of gauge theories that are featured this week and next. So we're not talking about twisted string theory here. There is a lot of work on that happening nowadays. So why in particular would we care about twists of gauge theories? I just sort of want to review some of the main examples and where this is all going. So in 40n equals 4 theories, there's electric magnetic duality. And the mathematics of that leads to, in particular, geometric Langlands. I should also say Waffle-Witten theory. And that story is also has to do with the twist of 40n equals 4 and electric magnetic duality. Much of the progress nowadays involves understanding like, deeper and higher categorical aspects of Langlands. And trying to say more about the math from the physics. In the n equals 2 world, A is going to give a talk tomorrow, I think. So in 40 n equals 2 theories, there isn't just a single duality, there are many. They're webs of electric magnetic like dualities. And the sort of math one gets from them involves Seiberg-Witten geometry, Hitchin systems, wall crossing, Conchaved Seugelmann type wall crossing, theories of class S, associated VOAs and dualities among them, and all sorts of stuff like that. So Faye will give an introduction to some of these things this week, and then there will be research talks on this stuff next week. The AGT correspondence fits in there. And then in three dimensions, in the n equals four world, there's a distinguished duality called 3D mirror symmetry. And the mathematics of that, well, in a topological twist, topological twists, what one expects to find is a list of homological mirror symmetry to two categories. It's sort of a big goal that many of us are working towards. But also, little pieces of this involve the sorts of applications to knot homology that Lev is talking about. Applications and extensions of symplectic duality. Is how I got into this whole business after listening to some lectures of Ben's many years ago on symplectic duality. So these all have to do with topological twists of 3D n equals 4. And then everything we've been hearing about elliptic cohomology and stable envelopes. Elliptic cohomology in the hyperkähler setting. That comes from holomorphic topological twists of 3D n equals 4. And that's beautifully explained, though not exactly from the same holomorphic topological perspective, in work of Kolya and Nekrasov, and Matt Bollemore and Daniel Zhang. So those are both recent-ish papers that I was hoping to say a lot more about in connection to the HT twist. I'm not sure if I'll get to that at the end of this talk. But maybe in the discussion later, I'll try to make some of those connections. And then there's 3D n equals 2. Which doesn't have a topological twist. Also, same up here. So 4D n equals 4 has a topological twist. In fact, many of them. 4D n equals 2 does have a topological twist. That's the Donaldson twist. But a lot of what's been happening nowadays, particularly involving things like Hitchin system and cluster categories and so on, that doesn't sit in the topological twist of 4D n equals 2, the Donaldson twist. The Donaldson twist just doesn't have a very interesting extended structure. There are no line operators in it. A lot of what's been happening nowadays and what we'll hear about next week ought to fit in a holomorphic topological twist of 4D n equals 2. This is as a little roadmap for reference. Right, and so last bit of this, 3D n equals 2 does not have distinguished dualities, but rather has vast networks of dualities. I don't think physically that they're they're completely understood. In abelian theories, I think we've mapped things out, but in non-abelian theories, there are just many examples and new ones coming out. It used to be every few months. So we have families of examples, but they're big webs of dualities. Some areas where there are big webs of dualities, the only twist you can actually look at is the holomorphic topological one. And places where 3D n equals 2 theories have become very relevant involve invariants of 3 manifolds. So there are 3D n equals 2 theories labeled by 3 manifolds. Such that various algebraic objects that one could compute about these theories, or partition functions, or so on, give topological invariants of the 3 manifolds. Part of 3D correspondence. Similar to the appearance of Hitchin systems here, there are 4D n equals 2 theories labeled by surfaces. And so current work on, say, categorification of quantum invariants of 3 manifolds, a lot of that has been going via these associated 3D n equals 2 theories. And I should add, Kolya mentioned this too, like elliptic cohomology doesn't just make sense for hyperkähler spaces. Should be a story for varieties, and that would be in a 3D n equals 2 holomorphic twist. It's the end of my long introductory digression. Happy to digress even more on this in the discussion session this afternoon, which is open. And I think we'll just gather and take some questions then. Okay. So I want to go back here, describe the holomorphic topological twist of that in a little more detail. Hopefully I'll have time to then extend to 3D n equals 4 in the same sort of formalism. Many of the things I'm going to say, in particular in terms of formalism, come from a paper of mine with Kevin and Davide a few years ago, and are the 3D n equals 4 generalizations are really nicely laid out in a note of Nick Garner's from a few months ago. So I would recommend Nick's paper if you want to know more details in this particular formalism that I'm about to describe. Okay. Before going to formalism, so I actually wanted to say a little bit first about general structure, like what you expect to find. So as Kevin said, spinners in 3D are two-dimensional. The supersymmetry algebra is generated by two of them. Which are often written as Q and Q bar, though there's no really useful meaning to the bar in this setting. And the so alpha runs over 1 and 2, that's the two-dimensional spinners. The physics way of writing the supersymmetry algebra, that the non-zero commutators only involve pairing up Qs and Q bars, and one finds uses some Pauli matrices and finds that commutators of Qs and Q bars involve translations. The Pauli matrices are intertwiners between two copies of the spinner representation of SO3. It's two copies of the spinner representation of the vector representation. Great. It helps to choose coordinates and to locally work on a space that looks complex in two directions and real in one direction. And this at this point, the splitting is totally arbitrary. There's full rotation invariance. But if we choose such coordinates and some basis for these intertwiners, then we can write the commutation relations like this. The plus supercharges commute to a DC bar derivative, the minus supercharges commute to a Z derivative, and the pluses and minuses with each other commute to a T or time derivative. Okay. This, so just to say a few more basic things. So what do I mean by supercharges and this algebra? So this is a thing that acts on, this is an infinitesimal symmetry of the space of fields. So let's do the algebra. It's an infinitesimal symmetry of the space of fields of whatever theory we're talking about. These are sections of bundles of sections of some bundles on C times R. Saying it's an infinitesimal symmetry means in particular that the Qs and the thing I call derivative here should embed into it means that they're tangent vectors, that they're vector fields that represent the symmetry, and thus acts on operators which can be thought of as functions of the fields. In particular, this Suzy algebra acts on local operators so local operators least perturbatively, are functions of the fields supported in the infinitesimal neighborhood of a point in spacetime. So if we choose a point in C times R with coordinates Z and T, local operators at that point means functions on the infinite jet space of fields at this point. These local operators are the basic things that enter correlation functions. That the first things that physicists start computing with. When I write something like derivative, sitting inside the supersymmetry algebra, what I am thinking of is, well, in terms of fields, it's like literally shifting the sections a little bit, differentiating in a particular direction, and local operators depend on point. They're functions on this jet space, and you can take derivatives in the jet space. The HT twist in this local setting, where I've chosen a splitting. So the HT twist that will make dependence on Z holomorphic and dependence on Z bar and T trivial. Involves using T plus bar in the conventions I've written down and taking cohomology. And then Kevin pointed out that, why would I choose that? So T plus bar commutes with other supercharges to give Z bar translations, and it commutes with T minus to give T translations, but it doesn't trivialize or it doesn't make Z translations exact. And the upshot one upshot is that correlation functions of few closed, local or otherwise, few closed operators only depend holomorphically on Z. And when I say holomorphic, I mean one can always encounter singularities in correlation functions when the supports of operators get close to each other. So what happens here is that those singularities can be meromorphic. When I say holomorphic, I mean as long as you don't let two operators get close to each other. So then what sort of things do we gain from this? So Davide said a little bit of this yesterday afternoon. So, bulk local operators, local operators, gains the structure of a commutative vertex algebra. That's really nothing but restating the claim that bulk loop, sorry, I mean Q-cohomology homology of this. Q-cohomology of full-on physical bulk local operators. So that's just restating the fact that part of that is restating the fact that the dependence on positions depends only on the z's and not the z bars or the t's. The commutative part moreover says that there are no singularities when the z positions are brought together. So commutative means no singularities. And in vertex algebra land, one would say that the OPEs are not singular. So it's the limit z goes to w by 1z to w exists. The reason for that is because of the t. So in the full-on physics theory, we can get a singularity whenever we bring the supports of two operators close to each other. But we can move them apart in the t direction for free. And so we can always bring them close in Z while keeping them finitely separated in T. Moving them apart in T doesn't change any correlation functions. And so if we get the same answer when they're at finite T separation, there can't be any singularity as their Z supports get close to each other. The other bit of structure here that I won't say anything about in this talk is that there are some canonical higher operations, sort of L infinity like higher operations, and the first one of those, well, the one that's canonical, is a bracket. So it's not just a commutative vertex algebra, but it's a commutative Poisson, shifted Poisson vertex algebra. On a boundary condition, this game of moving apart in the t direction no longer holds. And so on a boundary condition, one can get vertex algebras with non-trivial LPs, given boundary condition B. Now the picture looks like this. We're working on a half space times C. Placing the boundary along the complex direction, and there's again some space of local operators supported on the boundary, and if I can't move these operators apart, then they have a chance of having a singular OP. So we'll get potentially singular, or potentially non-commutative vertex algebra. There's a bulk boundary map, so you can ask, when is it commutative and when is it not commutative? And the answer is that the things that commute are things that come from the bulk. So we also get a bulk boundary map, beta, that says that given any bulk local operator inserted into any correlation function, we can take a limit where that bulk local operator sort of approaches the boundary. A limit isn't actually even necessary since the t direction is constant. So the structure of correlation functions and independence of certain directions automatically gives us this map from V to V boundary. The map depends on the boundary condition, and it lands in the center. And so the answer to how non-commutative this boundary algebra is that anything that commutes, anything that has non-singular OPEs with everything else, had better come from the bulk. That's subjective. Okay. There are extra symmetries around. These bulk and boundary vertex algebras are graded by spin that plays the role of a conformal grading. This chalk is so good, but it is falling apart. V and V boundary. They're graded by spin. What do I mean by that? In the nicest cases, that's a Z grading, though it might become rational. In other words, in less nice cases, that might be a Q grading. I hesitate to make fully general statements because various things can get broken. What I mean by spin is literally rotation. In C, around the support of a particular operator. So here's our complex plane. We have an operator in it. The space of local operators at that point is a representation of the rotation group in the plane. So we get a grading by spin. And if we're lucky, we will also get a grading by what's called R symmetry. That's been mentioned a few times. Which again, in nice cases, is Z, but that might become Q or something potentially more horrible. So where does the R symmetry come from? So the R charge is an additional U1 symmetry. Or C star symmetry, since we're going to do things in a complex way, of fields. Compatible, sorry, what's the way to say this? That extends the supersymmetry algebra in the sense that the Q's have weight 1 and the Q bars have weight minus 1. Me switch those. In other words, the symmetry is in the sense that Collier was saying before, the symmetry does not commute with the action of supersymmetry. It forms an extension of the Susi algebra, and such that you bar have these weights. The upshot is that if we're using Q bar plus as our differential, this R charge produces for us a cohomological degree. So one of these symmetries of the vertex algebra is sort of an ordinary symmetry. You often call it the conformal grading in VOA world. The other one is a homological degree. So this is homological or cohomological. And that's sort of a general thing you should expect when you hear about R symmetries in physics. Some combination of R symmetries under which the thing you twist with has degree one will produce a cohomological grading. Once we know that there are some gradings around, we can consider graded characters. And these have names. So I should point out, if you've had experience in a vertex algebra setting, you know that the underlying vector space of a vertex algebra is infinite dimensional. That's what you would expect in this sort of holomorphic context, because if you have any sort of local operator at a point, you can start taking z derivatives of it, holomorphic derivatives, and getting more and more and more local operators. And so V and VB are generally infinite dimensional. And the characters of these infinite dimensional things make sense if we grade them. So the character of V, by which I mean trace of minus 1 to the R, Q to the J, where J is weight, weight under spin, and R is weight under that U1 or C star symmetry. So this thing is, if you're lucky, some convergent function, if you're lucky, your spins will be bounded from below, and you'll have finite dimensional spaces in each spin. And this will make sense as a formal series in Q, and this is called the 3D index. Which played a big role in 3D correspondence things. The character of the boundary vertex algebra is defined the same way. And is called the half index. And is intimately related to the sort of theta functions that were showing up in elliptic cohomology. There's no way I'm going to have time to talk about that now, bit of a preface, preview. The Hilbert space of 3D HT twisted theory on an elliptic curve is elliptic cohomology. It ends up having there isn't just a single Hilbert space, there's a sheaf of Hilbert spaces over some dual elliptic curve, or some copies of some dual elliptic curve having to do with global symmetries that showed up in Andre's talk. If you want to produce classes in elliptic cohomology, or states in this Hilbert space, or globally, as you're moving around this elliptic curve, you produce sections of line bundles, then you throw in boundary conditions. The state on the, it's a terrible torus. The space of states on elliptic curve times time for a fixed holomorphic flavor connection on the elliptic curve. That's a point in that product of curves that Andre told us about. This Hilbert space is the fiber of some vector bundle over some dual elliptic curves. An element in this vector space fiber can be obtained by throwing a boundary condition. Now working on E times R plus, the boundary condition will generate some state. That's how one can try to fit the whole elliptic cohomology and stable envelope game in here.
Tudor.
Yes.
So, isn't this Hilbert space a bit too big for that? You should sort of restrict to a subspace. Like, the Hilbert space and the holomorphic topological twist is infinite. Still infinite dimensional, right?
No, the Hilbert space on a compact curve won't be. Sorry, Kevin.
There's something that people have looked at before. Apologies, I'm forgetting his name. There's a Dan Brobe-Gevens. Suppose you want to model elliptic cohomology. You'd say, let's look at functions of the mapping stack to some variety from elliptic. That's not right, because it gives you differential forms in the target instead of Ram cohomology. So similarly here, if you just take a free chiral multiplet, you'd find differential forms on wherever the chiral multiplet lives. Now, on the Durham differential, you still have to rotate the elliptic curve. Like you're secretly using the fact that when you go down to one dimensional, there's extra supercharges. So I mean, it's a quibble, but I think you can make it work by doing that.
Yeah, we can discuss it in the problem session because there's actually some problem which will
No,
precisely
yeah,
illustrate
sorry,
this
that would.
point.
Also, after I said that like it's not infinite dimensional. I mean, sometimes it is. It's not horrible. It's just you're taking you get the Hilbert space as d'Albault distributions on some finite dimensional thing. But turning on mass parameters and getting a massive theory surely plays a very important role in that story. As well, and then you might expect the Hilbert space to like to just collapse to C for each vacuum. And I, yes, it would be great to discuss that later. I also wish that Matt and Daniel were here, so I think they've thought about this deeply. But the claim in the computation is that by in fact the thing one does is to take various boundary conditions here, pair them with thimbles, pair them with massive vacua at the other end, and get some partition function, and that's the theta function. Another way to compute that theta function is to take the character of a vertex algebra that you also get from sort of pairing a boundary condition here with a vacuum up here. This like partition function on a torus is nothing but compute character of a vertex algebra. I should like I also don't want to make this sound. I don't want to make it sound like I understand this better than I do. This is how the story ought to work. I think there is a lot, in particular in the connection with vertex algebras. I think Andre also mentioned that, like, that's the expectation that they play a big role in here. I think that there are things to work out about that, which is in part why I was excited about sort of combining these topics in these workshops. I think like what right. As I keep talking for the next half hour, I'll like mention more algebraic and categorical things that appear in 3D n equals 2, and I would really like to connect these algebraic and categorical things with maybe the more concrete stuff that shows up in elliptic cohomology and also in quantum K theory. So one of these higher categorical things has to do with line operators. Also for like for the students, you th think like we're asking me yesterday like what's actually. Like it sounds like everything is known, what's not known. I like here, like we're really at the stage of like figuring out what the right mathematical structure is and then starting to populate it with interesting examples and trying to write down the correct mathematical definitions of the various objects I'm discussing. Right, so line operators. In the HT twist, line operators preserved by Q form a category. So these are line operators at a particular value of z extended along time. And one needs a topological direction along the line in order to talk about categories in the usual sense. And by usual, I mean DG. So the reason one needs the line direction to be topological is so that composition of morphisms makes sense. And in cohomology, morphisms should form an algebra or an algebraoid. And that, so what are morphisms? A morphism between two lines, which are objects of this category, is a local operator at a junction between them. And collision of junctions only makes sense, in other words, is only independent in cohomology of the position between those junctions, of the distance between those junctions, if this direction is topological. This is composition. There, in, call this category something, there's an object that just corresponds to the trivial line doing nothing, call it one. And endomorphisms of the trivial line are both local operators. And so the vacuum module of this bulk vertex algebra should be endomorphisms in this category of one. And the expectation is that a certain twisted version, sort of spin twisted, of Hochschild homology of C should reproduce equivariant depends on which parameters you throw in, but I think I want to do this, equivariant quantum K theory. This category itself has not been defined except in some trivial examples. I think they're difficult, infinite dimensional things one needs to do mathematically to get it. There are some obvious guesses. And I think the relation to quantum K-theory as K-theory of, this ends up being roughly coherent sheaves on the loop space of the target of the 3D theory. That relation is expected, but again, hasn't really been made precise. It's something I'd also love to see. I'll do the same thing that Davide did, just throw out things that would be lovely to make more precise. K-theory of what? Well, if we have some variety X that appears as, say, the stable locus of a stack V mod G, and we consider 3D gauge theory with matter V and gauge group G, then we expect that relation to hold for the category of lines in the 3D gauge theory, get related to quantum K theory of K. Quantum K theory of X. Okay. Now, there is more in the structure of lines. So, lines can collide with each other in the Z direction. And naively, that you might think that could lead to singularities. And it turns out that Kant for some nice reasons. So you could ask the following question. Consider a correlation function in the presence of two line operators at positions Z and W. What happens? Maybe some other stuff far away. What happens when Z approaches W? Is this singular or not? And it turns out it isn't. And it actually turns out that this is locally constant. For a reason that I can only explain with the full supersymmetry algebra, there should be a better way to do it. It turns out that configurations that are time independent or correlation functions of configurations of operators that are time independent, such as these line operators that are just stretching along time, are also independent of Z. And so in fact, it doesn't matter what Z minus W is in that correlation function. You can bring them together as long as everything else is also lines. As long as you don't have a little local operator there, because that'll screw up the time translation. And the quick argument for that is the following. These time-independent configurations, all operators in here, preserve not just Q plus bar, but also the thing that commutes with it to give time translation. So they had a commutator that looks like this. And one can run the same argument that shows if all your operators in a correlation function are, this was our Q, by the way. If all the operators in our correlation function are Q closed, then any symmetry that's Q exact will act trivially. Any sort of translation that's Q exact will act trivially on the correlation function. And so the rough argument here is that one can consider yet another almost differential, the sum of bar Q minus. This doesn't square to zero, it squares to time translation. If all we care about are operators that are invariant in time, then it does square to zero, and we can use that as a differential instead. And I guess the upshot is that time invariant things preserve not just our original Q, but also this Q tilde, and Z translation is, which I had left the algebra up. Z translation is Q tilde exact. DZ is the commutator of Q tilde and Q bar minus. Anyway, upshot, there's a tensor product. This category has a tensor product, at least among objects, but it doesn't behave quite the way a tensor product ought to. If we include morphisms, which are point-like and screw up time translation invariants, If we include morphisms, we can get singularities. And I'll just write down the expectation. Pavel Safronov pointed out that this thing existed mathematically, told me to look at papers of Jan Seubelmann. And so we expect something that Jan Seubelmann called a meromorphic tensor category.
Is it so? It seems conceivable to me that a line operator could preserve Q bar, could be preserved by Q bar plus, but not Q minus. Is there a reason why, if it's preserved by Q bar plus, which is like an element of our category of line operators, that it's automatically?
Yeah. So I skipped
invariant under Q minus.
I tried to skip over that. If I start from a supersymmetric theory, my line operators will preserve a one-dimensional SUSY subalgebra. That necessarily includes something that will anti-commute with Q to give time translation. There are no supersymmetric line operators that don't also preserve Q minus. There might be things one can do in a twisted setting that break this, and I'm not fully sure.
I mean, aren't there things that are like closed but not exact? I would imagine like exact things are invariant under both, but the closed things don't need to be co-closed, so to speak.
I don't think I understood what you were implying with that.
Well, if I imagine Q bar plus is like the Durham differential, and Q minus is the co-differential.
Exactly.
Things can be closed, but not co-closed.
No, that's right. But I'm not talking about like the Hilbert space. I just mean like the one-dimensional theory that you couple to define that line operator, like has an action of both D and D dagger.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. That's all that's needed.
Okay, great.
And otherwise, like yes. So the arguments sound very similar to what you would do in quantum mechanics to compare like Durham cohomology and harmonic forms. You can sort of describe them both ways. And I guess what I'm saying here is like take the thing that would have given you harmonic forms.
Okay, great.
I think it's analogous to that. And so just to give a picture, so what I mean by morphisms not behaving quite as you would expect in an ordinary monoidal category. So if we have the configuration like this, with three line operators in a junction, and put this at C and W, and other stuff far away. That may need to be re-expressed as you can write a single line and a junction between L tensor L prime and L tensor L double prime, but the local operators that fit here may involve singularities in Z minus W. And so what I want to write is sum 1 over Z minus W, some N. And so it's an OPE, but it's an OPE of junctions of line operators. That's the thing that can be singular. And I mentioned this because I think it's sort of fun structure that part Victor and my student Wenjun and I are trying to say something more concrete about, but it's the structure that ultimately should lead to covariant quantum K theory upon decategorification. Okay, so right, so good. I've gotten through a third of what I wanted to say. I was going to start populating these abstract expectations with some simple examples that I actually understand.
Could I ask you a quick question?
Hey, Don.
What was the class of field theories whose line operators you were saying have this structure?
It's HT twists of 3DN equals 2. The analogous version in 4DN equals 2 is maybe better known or expected. So line operators in the HT twist of that form a category with a categorical notion of spectral R matrices. I think that's something Kevin has told me about, and Harold Williams and Sabin Kadis wrote some brief things about that and their work. That's the analogous feature, one dimension up. Cool. Okay. So, I want to do some examples. And I was going to go through general gauge theories, but I'll just do matter. Examples come. Remind you what the data is. So we have a group that I'll think of as complex reductive, and physicists would use the maximal compact form. And a complex representation, and a superpotential is a gene variant function on V, and a transignment level, which roughly class in H4BG, which just means a bilinear pairing on the Lie algebra. Okay, so I want to ignore the group part of this. Suppose we just have free matter, or possibly matter with superpotential. So V, in physics, one would talk about chiral multiplets. Valued in V. Or no, I mean, one wouldn't even say that. One would take the dimension of V and say that's N, and then say we have a theory of N chiral multiplets. In the twisted BV formalism that I learned from Kevin, one constructs a theory the following way. I'll set up the Lagrangian and then actually make you compute things with it in the problem session this afternoon. So Kevin mentioned this but didn't write it down. He had a little bit. So let me write it. I'll make some comments and stop. locally in this flat local space-time that C times R, we get a field that looks like a differential form involving dz bar and dt components times some potentially arbitrary power of dz. So what's the game here? Dz bar and dt are going to have homological degree 1 and should be thought of as anti-commuting. So this is sort of a standard differential form. The extra dz I'm throwing on is really only there to keep track of the weight under the spin symmetry. So this little j is just the degree for the spin gradient. It will make sense once we start to integrate. And there's a dual field psi. Everything is supposed to be shifted symplectic. So psi is also a form in dz bar and dt, the things that are being trivialized. It's valued in v dual rather than v, and has some other spin degree such that the two add up to 1 and is shifted in homological degree. Kevin wrote one component of phi, one component of psi in his action for matter theory. So Kevin wrote something that looks like eta d phi, where d prime was z bar derivative. It's an exterior derivative in the z bar and t directions. And so little phi is the leading component of big phi. And eta is the one form component of psi. That's the one form. And I would say that this full twisted BV action looks like psi d phi. let me give you some rules for doing things with the BV action. Say how it relates to Kevin's things into physics. We actually might as well throw in a super potential as well. So this is the analog of a physical kinetic term, and if we've got a super potential, just add W of, assuming W is a polynomial, just replace, it makes sense to evaluate it on this entire multiform. BV rules in a minute. Classical BV, which is good enough for this. So the space of fields should be, please correct me if I get my sign wrong, minus 1 shifted symplectic. Which means functions on fields has degree +1, +1 bracket. which I need to define for you. And it's the one that just pairs phi psi. It's induced by saying, I just use x as the coordinate. And it's induced by saying that the bracket between phi and psi is a delta 3 form. And then everything else follows. Everything else, I mean, in the BV formalism, there's a natural differential, which is going to be my physical supercharged cube, which is the only bit of the physical theory that survives in this twisted formalism that is useful for computing things. The Q that's been the same Q gets expressed as bracket with the action, and Q squared is zero if and only if the action bracketed with itself is zero, which is the thing that's called the master equation in BV land. And I will, I think I will stop there and set up some things for you guys to compute and play with in the problem session.
Any questions?
So in the bulk of the 3D theory, you had a commutative Poisson algebra. What happens on the boundary where you have this non-commutative vertex algebra? What happens to the Poisson structure?
So that has to do with the bulk boundary map. The boundary condition needs to be isotropic. It's the Poisson version of being. Darn it. It's the Poisson version of being isotropic. So it's what you would in terms of varieties. If you have a Lagrangian sitting inside a symplectic manifold, or something slightly smaller, hence isotropic is actually the constraint. Then you know that the symplectic form vanishes when you restrict it to that submanifold. And one can dualize that to a statement about functions. And the dual statement about functions is the correct one to use in this setting. So the bulk algebra has a Poisson bracket, and that Poisson bracket has to behave nicely with respect to the boundary condition. And then the actual constraint is that the boundary condition needs to be isotropic.
Thanks.
Hi. This category of line operators in the bulk, this is in the presence of this is in the presence of no boundary condition.
Correct. They're independent features. So you can also talk about how they interact, and the bulk line operators should define modules. For a boundary vertex algebra, and what you would actually want is that there's an isomorphism between the category of modules for a boundary vertex algebra and bulk lines. I think that's what we actually see, but I don't yet have a strong reason to believe that's an isomorphism rather than just a functor in general.
I actually had a question. So I know you kind of gave this argument here.
That's me.
For this thing you said that you called a meromorphic tensor category. But I was kind of surprised or something. Like, I might have naively thought that if I had some defects, like, I guess, line operators in holomorphic codimension one, that I would get something like a chiral category, which maybe I have a cartoon in my mind. Rather than getting, like, the way you've written it, it looks like, at least on objects, you have something almost like a bifunctor that would be a usual monoidal structure. You're not getting any singularities in, like, the objects or whatever, which, I don't know. So are you kind of telling me here that I can't get a chiral category?
Well, I think I'm saying this is a particularly nice version of a chiral category. So I also expected chiral categories, and then we computed and found there are no singularities, and then realized there was a reason for it. At least if the objects that you're dealing with actually descend from supersymmetric lineup, like from half BPS supersymmetric line operators, and in the supersymmetric theory, then you won't get singularities of lines. And I think they all do, but I keep being surprised. So I'm not going to make a completely sure claim that, like, there is nothing in the twisted theory that doesn't come from the supersymmetric, from the underlying supersymmetric theory. Maybe you can define something weird. And that would then violate this structure.
Okay, thanks. Any other questions?
I mean, it's sort of related to the product in quantum K theory existing.
Which is, like, not singular or something.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like quantum K theory doesn't have a singular product. It's a standard.
On that note, have you looked at this thing they call it, like, quantum Hikita or something like that? Like, Joel and Michael and other Nick have this paper. I think it's sort of supposed to be about something like this.
That is, Hikita things tend to live in 3D n equals 4, and...
Yes.
Yes. So totally, quantum Hikita. You want it's 3n equals 4 with another circle on top. That circle isn't being categorified. I'm not sure one needs to make arguments like that in the Hikita setting. But yes, sorry. I think that's local operators in 3D n equals 4. It's local operators in Hilbert spaces, and 3D n equals 4. That 3D n equals 4 plus. So with a actually coming from four dimensions on a circle to give you a K theory lift of cohomology, which is how quantum K theory is usually described. One starts with a two dimensional A model. And which is quantum cohomology for local operators, and then lifts that to 3D on C times a circle with a rotation while you're compactifying. And that's usually the setting, and one just says, like, line operators wrapping that circle give you classes in quantum K-theory. This ought to be the categorification of that statement, where if you don't have a circle, you just think of C times R.
Okay, well, if there are no more questions, let's thank Tudor again.